Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Tunaris podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Tunaris podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined as always by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
Our guest today is Paula Carney. How are you, Paula?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. You have a similar background to ourselves, and you're a community worker in Dublin at the moment.
Yeah.
Where are you from?
I'm originally from Summerhill, but live in Finglas now at the moment.
Mm. What was it like growing up in Summerhill?
Do you know, I actually loved it. Mm. The Northern Sea, it's one of them communities when there's, like, there can be chaos in a one day. Mm. But if something goes wrong, they're one of them communities that really pull together. Yeah. So I think that's sort of true in a lot of working class communities. Yeah. Do you know, there's a real strong community spirit. Now, lately, over the past few years, with everything that's going on, obviously there's fractions. But again, once that happens, they are a very strong community.
Yeah. And that's 99% of the community, yeah, really, isn't it? Yeah. It's like these small fractions are just certain groups of people, but the actual community itself is built of the 99% of people that are just love their area, love the people in the area, and they're the most outgoing people that you can ever meet, because they all say, hello, how are you? Do you know?
That's one thing about working class communities. You're walking, it could take you an hour to get down the road somewhere, and you know, so you're just like, yeah, hey, if you're in a hurry, you'd find letting on, you don't see people and just walk.
My wife says, even now, to me, do you know, if you're going to Lidl, make sure you put the mask on, because There's never once have I ever gone to the shop. It's only 2 minutes across the road that I've came back after 5 minutes and gone half an hour, 40. You'd be bumping into people and you'd be chatting away. You know?
So, what was it like for you growing up?
Growing up, do you know something? I grew up in a house where there was myself. I have five siblings. Wait, five? Wait a minute. That count. Yeah. One brother. One sister and four. Yeah, five siblings. Yeah.
Six of us
all together. Yeah, but now, my dad had his issues with drink, but he was still a great father, so you know what I mean? Now, but was he a great husband to my mother? Not really.
Yeah.
Do you know, so I grew up, those domestic abuse, the usual crap that goes on in families like that. And I do understand that we also came from a community that was full of poverty, the whole lot, and all them put a lot of stresses on people. Mm. But now I have to say, now, as he got older, he really softened in his old age. He's dead now, Jesus, 11 years, 12 years. Mm. But it was tough at times, but still okay.
Could you relate today, I know, with your understanding around addiction and stuff, how maybe growing up in that kind of environment may have had some form of influence in maybe
definitely
your mental health and your addiction?
Yeah, definitely. And as well, I remember first when I came out of addiction, you know, thinking like, well, I'm the only one out of six of us that end up like this. But I also had other traumas that had went on from when I was a child. So it was different, you know what I mean? And my way of coping with that was to pick up a drug.
Yeah.
You know, like I was saying to you earlier, like without advocating for drugs, at times drugs saved my life. Do you know what I mean? Because I would have ended up, God knows, fucking.
And it's only people like us can really understand the real true benefit of that. You know, because when drugs came into our lives at a young age, the thinking, the ruminating in the head, the negativity, the constant critic of yourself and that I was worthless and bad or something wrong with me, that stopped.
Yeah.
Because no device in my head is, where am I going to get more money for more drugs?
Exactly.
Or more drink? You know, and that was the new voice.
You get cocky and confident, yeah, and all that comes when you're using drugs developed. And you're able to hide everything while you're using drugs.
So, you know, growing up, you had different things going on in your life. So,
yeah,
when did you start using Quala at a young age?
I would have started, say, taking the odd tablet here and there very early times, yeah, you know, and then drinking when I could, you know, like sneaking off, having a few joints, you know, the usual, like at 13, 14. But then around 16, the rave scene hit. And I started going to the raves and that, and it was just like, take whatever I could there. Do you know, I'm not going to lie, I had a fucking great time doing it.
Yeah.
Do you know, so there's no point in lying about it. I had a great time doing it.
And that was the era.
Ecstasy,
and the love,
coke, and the love bomb, the whole lot, and all
like
that
the love
you get
back
with
then,
it. Yeah.
We always say, don't we? The love that we got from the MDMA,
do you know,
was powerful.
What you thought you were missing.
Like, it was powerful. You couldn't hate somebody on ecstasy. Like,
the camaraderie, the sense of belonging and friendship.
And like, if you even look at the raves and all years ago, if you go into a nightclub and everyone is drinking, like that, an argument is bound to break out somewhere. You go into a rave and everyone's just feeling happy. Do you know, it was mad. Like when you think back now, it was surreal. Do you know what I mean? Like you're looking around, everyone's in love with each other. Nobody's fucking fighting, punching the head off each other. Am I allowed to course, Harry?
Yeah, of course.
You're a freaky horse.
Well, if we weren't low course, anyway, I probably would be sitting here.
Actually, when I think back, you know, some of the early podcasts we did, I used to do a lot of cursing, but I try not to curse as much now because the audience is more diverse than we had imagined. So I thought like our audience might be like people like myself, Timmy, yourself, that would put more and more people from different backgrounds. Since we're trying not to curse, but you're free to curse if you like. What's school like for you back then?
School, do you know, I never really liked school. And it's mad though, I'm in college now and I love it. But when I was a kid, I hate school. Like, absolutely hate school. And I think as well, though, do you know the way, when you're in school, you're trying to fit in with everyone else, to like acting up and all that, and acting like you hadn't got a clue what was going on. When I look back at it now, I was actually quite intelligent, but just wouldn't use my brain because I didn't want to.
Yeah.
And I think as well, though, like I went back to college at 42, so it was completely different to when I was going. I do even say it to my own youngster, my 21-year-old, when I was asking him about going to college and all, I was saying, at least with college, you pick what you want to do.
Yeah.
It's not like you're being forced to do what
it's
someone else expects.
Yeah.
And I think for me, though, it was just, that was authority over me. And I didn't want authority over me, do you know, so.
It's very similar as well. Like, there was ability there, but I didn't like the teachers. I didn't like having to go to school, having to wear the uniform, having to sit in a science class that you hated or a maths class that, you know, German, you know. But when you go as an adult, then, like, you don't have to go if you don't want to go. Yeah. If you want to lay in bed, you can stay in bed.
Exactly.
I wouldn't do it, but you still had the choice.
Yeah.
You don't have to go sit in a maths class or a science class. You go and you study things that you're interested in. And that's it.
Yeah.
And it's different. It's way different.
It's completely different.
And as an adult, the teachers don't have the authority over you than they do as a child, where they can treat you a little bit poorly and talk down to you. Whereas when you're an adult, everybody's at the same level. And you can speak up for yourself and stuff like that, you know. It's less hierarchical, you know.
Yeah, and I think skills back then, though, like I was only listening to your podcast the other day with John Connors.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the classes. And I remember that from Gardiner Street School, like why we all had air classes, you know, like say from junior infants all the way up to sixth class. Members of the Traveller community were in, it's the library now on Gardiner Street School. They were all lumped into that together.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So you start to see all that from an early age. So I think I've always been the type of person that I'd notice things like that.
Yeah.
So I'd no respect for it.
Yeah.
Do you know?
It was like that
so.
In St. Mary's on the Hill. It's primary school. Yeah. That Travellers would be in one class. And I can remember stuff coming out over the intercom around like, hello, Miss Ford, how many Travellers have you got in your class today? And all stuff like that. Like,
Yeah.
And they'd have to come to travel. And I remember as well, Travellers being in our class that would be way older than us. And then way younger, it's like they would get moved up and down years.
Yeah.
Like, and then they'd be in second class and then they're doing their confirmation next year. Like they're, and then they're moved
and
on.
That was
you know?
The only time they were allowed into with us was during, because I remember sitting in the church and there was two Travellers was in the church where I was making their confirmation. But when you look back now, you're like, fuck, But then you listen to people on the likes of Twitter and all constantly putting their members of the travel community and then the parents don't send them to school. I'm being honest with you, if I knew that I'm sending my school to a child to be treated like that, and then after doing all this studying, that if you look at the statistics that not a lot of people will say they'll hire a traveller, why would you send them through it?
And even if they are in school, then what's going on in the school that represents their culture?
Exactly.
There's nothing in there that celebrates their music, their language, horses. It's a very kind of a rigid and one-dimensional system where this is the ideal way to live. And if you're outside of that,
you're different.
You've nothing to relate.
It is time for change, though, in the system. There has been some changes slowly around the different ways kids have been taught, and there's more knowledge around different learning differences and different kids. Like today, I've gone into schools, right? And some of the schools have more SNAs than they have teachers.
Yeah.
More like across the board. Yeah. And I think it's great. It's great, but also at the same time, would it not be very important, and I always say this, and I never get sick of saying this because I think it's very important and people need to listen to it. If we did have a system set in place for kids at a young age to be able to see what works for them and what doesn't work for them, and let's teach them in a way that they can benefit from school instead of school being a place that they get very stressed and anxious at.
Yeah.
And they enjoy going in there,
And you could do that. Like if they could do something similarly to college where you have your core subjects that most students will do. And then, if you're doing, I'm doing social policy at the moment, so there'll be a core subjects that we have to do, and then we get to pick our electives, on what we want to study.
Yeah.
So if they've done something like that with the kids, but on what you're saying about kids, members of the travel community, and I'm not saying, a few, just before Christmas, my kids' school sent out a survey, a few questions about anything you'd like changed. And my 8 and 9-year-old helped me fill that in. And what they wanted was studies on African studies. Mm. And for more teachers that look like them to be in their school because there's none. That's an 8 and 9-year-old telling.
Yeah.
They're like, there's not, we've friends in our school that look like us, but we've no teachers.
Yeah, a bit more diversity. Even the social policy thing there, if you're ever stuck for anything there, give him a call, because there's your boy there on social policy.
I've got 2 weeks to do it.
But if you want to send it on, I something have a look. But a lot of teens, people will experiment. It doesn't matter where you're from.
Yeah.
But it got out of hand for you.
Yeah.
How and why?
I think because it helped me cope, and I let it get out of hand because that, with going out raving and that'd be the weekends, probably smoke weed during the week. But then I think with a lot of us, particularly from the north, and I see a lot of us, we'd be going to the asylum, then we'd end up on the top floor of the asylum at the end of the night smoking heroin to the ground. Or going back to a party and smoking heroin. And as much as that was a weekend thing, it started going to during the week. And I actually really didn't even think I was addicted to drugs until it was mad. Two of my best friends, I was in my friend's house, a friend that I was using with, and one of my best friends comes up and knocks. Are you walking around to the house? I'd been out all night, so I walked around. Gets to me gate and Sean's around and she says, all right, I have to go. And I says, what did you get me out for if you have to go? I need to do something for my ma. Lets me walk into my ma's. Do you have to go? And I'm telling my ma I was taking heroin. And I'm like, you fucking bitch.
Mm.
Now, give a couple of weeks, don't get me wrong, angry at force, but they're still some of my best friends now.
Mm.
And they were seeing that it was getting out of hand for me. Do you know what I mean? As much as we may have went up, don't need to get up, whatever, they were seeing the harder drugs come in and they were seeing me change.
Mm.
And they were seeing that I wasn't so much into going out clubbing anymore. It was getting more that I just want to stay home and do hard drugs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I do get where they were coming from. Do you know what I mean? And it was done genuinely because they cared for me. And that's still two of my closest friends.
Yeah.
We may not see each other as much now, but when we do see each other, it's just like
that was good awareness all around back then. I'd say Dublin must have been completely devastated with heroin at that stage. like, you know, in Cork, we didn't really get heroin until 2006 or 2007, where it really came in, the flood.
I'd say late 90s, Dublin, like, got really bad, and the marches started again with the, it was the Concerned Parents Against Drugs Force, and it was mad because I remember the Concerned Parents Against Drugs. I lived in Hardwick Street at the time where that started. I remember sitting on my dad's shoulders, what do we want? Push us out.
Mm.
10 years later, it flipped. Yeah. I mean, Ma's being told you not to have a horn in the house.
Yeah.
Do you know, like, so it was mad though. Like, do you know, as a little child sitting on my dad thinking, this is great going on these marches.
Yeah.
But then when you're older, you're like, it was vigilantism. And now, again, and then be fairly similar to the anti-refugee marches that are happening now, the majority of people that are on them, it is about concern and they're, what they're being fed.
Yeah.
BS. People I'm going to try and keep the language.
Yeah,
the wrong people hijack it, you know. But, and it was similar back then, do you know what I mean? Some people had their own agenda for it.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, I'll be honest, and I will say hypocrites when it comes to marching on people for drugs. And like, geez,
they're just doing it for the sake of it.
Brought them in, so don't even go there.
They're doing it for the sake of it.
A lot of addicts as well that wouldn't be dealing or anything like that getting slaughtered.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know what I mean? People who are just selling for their own habits.
Yeah. How did it escalate for you? Like from that night that you walked into your parents?
Do you know, it was for me, that's the same when I was saying about that, I walked into my mad and my dad was in treatment in, is it a Thai?
Yeah,
and my ma rang him. Now, they were separated and all at the time, but I knew my dad was coming up. Like, fuck, this ain't getting out of the house. I left the house and went to see my cousins and fatty my mansion.
Nice move.
Bit of a strategic move, my man is.
Unconscious as well, I'd say at the time.
Yeah. I'm very conscious.
Like, I knew if I'm around them flats, I'd be grand, you know. But, it wasn't until then though, that I realised I was addicted because I hadn't got it right beside me that I could go and get it. I had to go look at it. And I started to feel sick and I'm like, fuck, I honestly didn't think I was addicted to it.
Until you start to feel sick.
Until you fucking had to go through them withdrawals and everything like that. And then it was just start shoplifting for it.
And how did it from that point to maybe the day you stopped, like how did it go? What was the whole process through there? Like where did it bring you?
Yeah, do you know what? I started shoplifting to feed me habit, but luckily for me, I was actually a good shoplifter, so I never had to go any other route.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? So, like, and I'll always say about girls who have to go out and do sex work.
Mm.
For many, it's their only option. Do you know what I mean? So I'd never put a girl down for that.
Yeah.
So, and I hate to see. And especially when I see fellas putting girls down who have had our partners out doing it to feed their own habits. Do you know what I'm like?
But nobody can judge anyone else, Paula.
What people do is
you do whatever you have to do to get wherever you need to suit yourself
especially
with.
Especially an addiction. Do you know?
And we've all done shit that we're all not proud of and ashamed of. But you know what? At the time, we needed to do it to survive and to get us through what we did.
I was lucky enough that I was a good shoplifter.
Yeah.
But I still ended up in and out of prison for years because of it, you know what I mean? Spent a lot of time in jail between, I remember the old Mountjoy, when it used to be in St. Pat's.
The Two Norries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Limerick and the dope was constantly in and out. Yeah. Do you know, it was literally like a revolving door system, do you know, in and out. And like, just still, like, even when I went back up doing groups in the dope, there's still girls there that would have been there from the start when I was there. They're basically doing life sentences and installments, you know, it's like they get out for a week or two. And for many, that's a safety place, do you know what I mean? So, and unless you've lived it, you don't understand that.
Yeah.
No one, someone says that they feel safe in prison.
I know.
Do you know, you have to live.
Do you know a lot of the girls as well that are in and out.
Mm.
You know, I suppose some of the things that are happening to them then as well on the streets, like that actually keeps them in addiction even longer because they need their Like, that stuff is after hurting them even more, and they need to actually even sue themselves more. So the thoughts of stopping for them is something that the brain doesn't even want to go to, because they know that they're going to be left with all these different traumas. Like, what they may have started off on drugs for, maybe when childhood stuff and whatever else, but the stuff that happens whilst in addiction then,
exactly,
that's a different level of stuff, like, isn't it?
Yeah, and like, and you see a lot of young girls and women and all in addiction who suffer domestic abuse hugely. And like, we found, like, even through working in cell, that a lot of them, when it comes to reporting around, they won't report because they're treated like...
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
They're a complicit victim. Do you know that they played some role in it, because the argument may have started over drugs? That there's a bit of blame put on them, do you know, instead of just looking at them as victims of domestic abuse. Now, I will say, we started a project in Sale called the Divina Project. And the Divina means domestic abuse and violence is never acceptable. That's what the word stands for. But we had guards from Stour Street in the domestic violence unit, and I have to say they've been brilliant. Like, they come around, they've done a lot of work with Sale and all. And how they view people who use drugs now when they go into situations is completely different. Do you know, but again, that came from people with lived experience, talking to them and telling them, do you know, what it was like for them, that was able to give them a different perspective on it as well.
So Sale, the Sale group, for anybody that's not familiar with it, outside of Dublin, what's it all about?
Sale Project, now, that's, like, in my addiction, I ended up going to, I had my eldest son, Aaron. Jeez, I was 26 when I had him. I really showed me age. He's 21.
You didn't know him, yeah.
But yeah, I started Sale Project when he was only, I think, nearly one. But I'm not, didn't work for me at the time. Like, I was drug-free when I got pregnant, when I was drug-free for the first year or two. And then I slipped back into addiction. But I went back to Sale Project in 2011, which is a women's project in the North Inner City. It's just for women only, but it's the only all-women's project in Ireland. Well, it was up until Merchants Quay started one. But the amount of work that it does, because it's the type of project that you go in that, even though it's a drugs project, it barely focuses on the drug. It's all about making women's lives better, do you know what I mean? Educating women, do you know, really, really creating the conditions for them to be empowered. Do you know, so... Sale, when I went back, I started doing, I think I'd done my addiction studies there. I was had actually applied to go back to college, and I ended up, I was only in college 2 months, and I found out I was pregnant on my 9-year-old. And then I says, I'll defer till next year. Then I found out I was pregnant again, so I was like, I put that off for a while. But I did do my addiction studies now in CEL, but CEL, it's really sort of community development approach to working with women who use drugs and really taking them in. Like, they develop a lot of work, you know, with the peers, like they've developed work when, I don't know what he's now, the Reduce the Use program that would have been developed through CEL. Yeah, Cool Mind Use. But Recover Me, Solace the CEL. But they've programs in it called BRIO, which is Building Recovery Inwards and Outwards. Now, that's for women who have criminality and addiction in their story. And that's the one that goes into the DOCUS, you know what I mean? They go in then and work with women in the DOCUS. But it's the peers delivering, you know, training to the women and all.
Yeah.
So I remember going in before I ever worked in CEL as a peer to the DOCUS. That was when I'd done that presentation. Yeah. But going in, and the difference we're having someone that the women knew and could relate to.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It makes a lot of difference,
yeah, don't it?
And there's some amazing workers and projects who may have never used a drug in their life, but and are in it for the right reasons. But I do believe that lived experience piece makes people really be able to relate to each other, you know, and know that they're genuinely being heard and genuinely being
listened. Because you can feel it.
Yeah.
You can feel it across the table.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm sitting here with you and although we've had different experiences, we both know what it's like to get caught up in drugs and know that it's the most important thing in our lives and everything else goes up to swanny.
Yeah.
And we've no care for our own lives or anybody around us. And we're willing at any point maybe just give up whenever it happens because we've already given up.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a quality that only people who use drugs and have been caught up in addiction. Oh, you made a great point. Some of these people are in it for the right reasons and they're very well educated. But when you have somebody sitting across the room that is educated in this stuff, but also has the lived experience, it just gets a different level higher, doesn't it? And you're willing to listen to every word that's coming out of their mouth. And that's how I got it.
Yeah.
By having somebody with lived experience and also at the same time, they were a counsellor and they knew what they were talking about. And I said, whoa. He had the same, and that was it for me. It was like, if he can do it, I can do it.
That's the piece, isn't it? Being able to sort of see it.
Yeah.
Do you know, if you see someone's growth and someone's story, you know. But like for self, for me, it was very much, I started to have people who believed in me.
Mm.
Whereas I never felt that before, do you know what I mean? I always felt like, I'm just someone who uses drugs.
Yeah.
Do you know, and I'm not, nobody's going to respect me. So what's the point? So it's not like I'm ever going to get a job or anything like that. Yeah, I think you feed into the stigma that society puts on you and you start to believe it, you know, and it's very hard to break that. Like, I done a piece of work with the women in CEL on drug-related stigma. We were at the developing a manual, excuse me, and with Citywide in CEL and the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission had funded it. But the group of women, we were supposed to be 12 sessions, but went on for over a year just developing the manual, but the stories that come up in that, you know, about how women are treated when they come in. Because, like, as much as people who use drugs are stigmatized, women are stigmatized much harsher. And when it's a woman who happens to be a mother, it does extra layers of shame that are placed on her, you know, because there's an automatic link to, if it's a woman who's taking drugs, she couldn't be a good mother. I was a fucking great mother to my son, regardless.
Mm.
Do you know? But thankfully, my two youngest have never had to experience any of that. But I was still always there for my son. But I was also one of the lucky ones as well who had a family there that never walked away.
Yeah.
And a lot of the women that I work with now, many of them don't have any.
The kids go into care then.
And they're asked to put their kids into temporary, you know, voluntary.
Voluntary,
and make it almost impossible. And like at the moment I'm working in housing and I'm seeing where women are coming in and they've been asked to voluntarily sign their child over. But then what happens is they're in a hostel, a single person's hostel, and then they
don't have the accommodation to get the child back.
And then they don't have the criteria for that 2 or 3 bedroom house that they need because they don't have the child in their care. So to catch the 22 situation and you think that women are going to be able to jump through all these hoops while experiencing huge trauma that comes with losing that child. And then it's like,
do you know when we were in the DOCUS there about 2 months ago, we were in the DOCUS and we were in Limerick as well with the ladies. And something I suppose struck us in compared to the men was the level of mental health issues, and also a lot of the women in there. Like, when you're, from my experience anyway, when you go into prison, like, your main goal is to get out as fast as you can.
Yeah.
Whether that's bail, appeal, whatever, you know. But some of the women in there are 50 euros bail. They don't post bail.
Yeah.
Because they know where to go, or they're safe, or where they are. Like, can you talk to us about that? And did you experience that when you were in there? Do you, like, even today, do you see women in there? And why are they safer inside? And what stuff is going on for?
I think, especially now, where a lot of women and homelessness, prison is a safer option for them, unfortunately. Do you know, like, if you see how a lot of people are treated in them services, that's shocking. Do you know, like, with the Service Users' Rights and Action piece, we've just done a bit of research, and like, from talking to people and all, you know, who are living in hostels and whatever, they said how they're treated by the staff. Like, I've one girl at the moment, and only for, you know, she said something last week. I can't go into her details too much, but I'll just say about how the staff in one of the hostels was talking to her, and her own sister was like, "He wouldn't have said that yet." But her sister went up with her to collect her clothes then a few days later. And she was standing at the door and hearing them, how they were talking down to the girl. And I mean, this girl has had a horrific situation since being put out of hostel. But so for women, like constantly going into prison, it's safer than sleeping on the streets. And as you said, it could be only 50 euro bail. And for most of us, that's nothing. But if you have nobody to even post that bail, do you know what I mean? So as well, like, around your kids, the whole lot. And I think that burden is taken off them. If they're in there, I think they can relieve themselves of some of the guilt that there's nothing I can do from here. Do you know, so...
When I was working in services, there was a couple of predators, well-known predators, who would hang around the hostels and starting the women.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of women came to me, crying, hysterical crying and stuff like that. The girls would come, but they would never go ahead. Because if they make the statement, they still have to go to the hostel to score with methadone, to go to the post office. So there's a lot of stuff goes unreported.
Yeah.
But if they post bail, that's what they're going back to.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because we don't have the housing in our departments. Like, back in the day, you could save up your few quid while you're inside and get a bed set, you know, but down a deposit. Do you know what I mean? Them days are gone.
Yeah. Now there's not a hope. And then if people are in addiction and all that, it's very hard for them to even get a council place, you know, because if they do the Section 15 and the charges coming up, but if charges just gone, they're being told they have to wait another year. Yeah. Do you know, so it's like, you expect people to move on and get into recovery, but they've no stable place to go to start that.
Do you know if, there will be women in prison watching this, because this goes on to the prison TV channel. Hi to everybody.
Hello to everyone.
Do you know if there was a... you're a wise woman now, and you've had all these life experiences and education and stuff like that. Is there any bit of wisdom or advice or guidance you'd pass on to the younger you? Or maybe, like, because how we're talking there is, like, they could be thinking, what's the point? I'm never going to get a gaff, and, you know, all this shit. Like, what's out there for people, and what can they access to turn their lives around?
I think linking in with the right services that are really there to support you as you would, and taking help from anyone that you can get. But again, the right ones, you know, that they're doing it for the right reasons. And there is some great services around, you know, like there's great workers around the North, and I see you doing like the likes of Ishka and all, now doing really good outreach work and all.
They have a great piece around language and how we speak about people who use drugs, don't they?
And that's around the stigma piece, that person-centred language. You know, about sort of, I know it's a bit of a mouthful, people who use drugs instead of addict or instead of user. Or, you know, because I find, and I know some people will challenge me on the word addict, like when I just say it, you know, about it can be, it's not that stigmatized, and it can be very defining. You know, if you're calling someone like they're an addict, it sort of forgets all them other pieces of that person. You know, their mother, their sister, their brother, their father, friend, you know what I mean? So it forgets all them brilliant pieces about a person and just focuses on
for people in recovery, they might I suppose with the fellowship of being a recovering addict, and that self-labeling can be a positive in terms of they belong to a group.
Yeah.
But I think it's important for other people not to call somebody else an addict.
That's the thing. That's a bit different. Self, yeah. Mm. Self, it's different, you know. But as well, though, like, I challenge the word clean as well. Do you know, yeah, when someone refers to clean, because I'm like, when someone asks me, how long are you clean? It was never dirty.
Yeah.
I was, and I think when we use language such as clean, it can be very, it puts that assumption that when you're using drugs, you're a dirty person.
It's just a lack of awareness around, yeah, really, isn't it? That's all it is.
And
it's,
I think, because I've done, like, I've been involved in campaigns on stigma, so I think that's why I do so strong on, you know, challenging the language. But some, what I do, that groups like fellowships and all will use that, that's their language. And it's like, I suppose, where the LGBTQ community, some people have embraced the word queer.
Yeah.
So if it's empowering to people to use for themselves, but like that, it's just not language I'd use for myself.
Even the concept of recovery and the definition of recovery can mean different things to different people 100%. As well. Like if you're working with a lady that's, you know, come through, you know, poverty, sexual abuse, trauma and all this stuff, and they're living a quality of life where they're looking after their kids, the roof is over their head, and they have to take their methadone on a daily basis, they're in as much recovery as anybody else.
Exactly. And that's what, there's often a hierarchy, you know, that you're not really in recovery if you're on methadone, you know. And there is other options nowadays. Like, I know they've just started the Buvidal here in Ireland, and that's so, that could be great if it gets passed and people are actually offered it.
Is that like a Suboxone type of thing?
It's Suboxone, but it's a depot. It's injected into people once a month. So Suboxone, it breaks down that every day. Yet Suboxone's a tablet, but it's the same thing, except for Suboxone has naloxone in it.
That's right.
So if somebody takes opiates on top of it, it can put them into what's called, is it precipital withdrawals or something. It's a strong kind of withdrawal it puts you into. Very similar to taking antibiotics and drinking, but the Buvidal is you only have to go to the clinic once a month.
And
it's injected into you, it releases it into your system every day, gives people back their lives. Now people can walk, not having to make excuses to a boss every day to go to a clinic or every week.
But even going to the clinic can be triggering in and of itself. You're trying to move away from that kind of lifestyle, and you have to go to the Arbor House in Cork. If you have to go to the Arbor House every Monday, and you're surrounded by people selling tablets and doing it, knowing what you're looking at and all. It's like the less of that you're exposed to, the better.
The better. It's a lot easier if you're having to be exposed to it.
Drink that down, I'll show
you. Yeah, it's a lot easier if you're having to be exposed to it, you know. But I think, though, when, especially if you're like starting your recovery and you're not doing it in treatment centres around, you know, being in the community doing it can be a strong way of starting. If you can do it in the community, you know, because you're there. All them triggers are there. It's just learning.
What was your turning point? How did it come to a head for you?
Do you know what? I lied to my dad and told him that I was drug free. I did, before he died. I remember going to the hospital and sneaking into the, and at the time I'd got really bad on crack cocaine, sneaking into the toilet to have a pipe. But I felt so fucking guilty then, you know. But as well, though, after my dad had died, I had talked to, I was in, with my key worker in sale, and I was talking about trauma I'd been through as a kid, and I finally decided to tell my mother. And I think as well, I felt guilty that I never told my dad about it. But I never told my dad about it because the person that was about kind of knew my dad was could get aggressive and he had a temper, and he kind of switched that and made it feel that if I told my dad be the one that ended up in prison because my dad killed him. Do you know? So it was used against me. But it was when I spoke to my mother, that's when things started to really change for me. Do you know, when I finally started talking about the trauma and things like
that. She started to understand
it. Yeah. The response I got from her was brilliant, you know what I mean? But at the same time, it left her feeling a lot of guilt because she felt she didn't protect me. There was nothing she could have done to protect me, do you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
but that's the whole mother will think, isn't it?
Yeah,
like she forgets to put herself back into that time that probably happened where she was probably bringing up six kids and dealing with
working everything, you know, and everything
else. Yeah, you know, we tend to forget about those things and beat ourselves up because of other stuff. It's just normal for human beings to beat themselves up over stuff like that, isn't it?
Yeah,
because it's my belief we do the best we can at whatever stage of our lives with what we know.
Mm.
you know. And sometimes if you're behave, if all you know is just chaotic behaviors and mad stuff, and you'll behave in that way. But if you, if you're 10 years down the line and you're in recovery, you have to understand and put yourself into that context as well. I didn't know any better back then.
Yeah.
You know, back then I probably done this. And it's like listening to the gut. Like, we've all came across times in life, in our lives there where the gut has said,
don't do it. And you're going to
do it. And you do it and it's like, whoa.
Do you know, I've done that so many times. When
me too.
And even right now, go back to actually when I was there shoplifting Feed Me Have, I remember having them gut feelings in shops, you know.
Yeah.
You're going to get me to
feel. Not this time.
Nah, have your grants.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you're next, you know. Why didn't I listen to myself?
Yeah, but it's just that time, like something in here saying, after stream.
Yeah, and then you're still going to it.
Can you describe your pathway through recovery and education?
As I said, I started in the SAIR project, went back to the SAIR project. I had an amazing key worker there, and I do think it was the piece that he had a bit of lived experience as well. Like, so he was brilliant. The support I got there and all was great, and I started, as I said, on the addiction studies and that, and I think I, then I was planning on going, as I said earlier, I'd went to, what's the name of that? DIT I was at the time.
Yeah.
It's TUD now, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
But I ended up having my two kids, so I said I'd go back. Then I got accepted into it again, I think it was 2018. And but at the same time I was accepting into that, I was offered a chance to do a level A certificate on community education and equality studies with Minute, but it was being done in Sale. So I said, do that instead, because the one that I was doing was an access programme so that I could try and apply for college the following year. So then I done the equality studies, and then I went on and done my degree in community and youth work in Minute. So I finished that 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now, once I hand in my thesis, I'd be finishing my master's in human rights and social policy now.
Yeah,
2-3 weeks, I'd be finished that.
Yeah,
if I finish my thesis.
You will finish
it. I will.
You will, 100%. Fair. Like, that takes a lot.
Yeah.
It's very easy to say it, but it takes a lot out of us, particularly bringing up children as well, and having to provide financially for your family and stuff. It's tough. Particularly if you're somebody that education doesn't sit well very easily. So I take my hat off there, because I know how it feels, you know.
Because you're talking there, you're listing off the courses and they're all off at home. But, like, that's hours of sitting in front of the laptop, reading books. There's no, like, the idea of doing a course and doing a degree is nice, but there's no one can sit in front of that laptop for hours, for years.
Years.
And do a fire. You have to do that, and the discipline, the sacrifice, because I know, man, when I was a student, you're broke as a fucking house. Yeah. But you're grinding with the goal of getting the qualification, then getting the job. Mm. And when you can do that, then there's no greater feeling. But if I was to give advice to somebody that was starting out, my advice would be, if you can do a level 5, you can do a degree.
Exactly.
Because if you can do the, if a degree is harder, but if you can do level 5, it'll set you up really well for the degree. I wouldn't have had the confidence or the ability to do the degree. The level 5.
Same. That's why I done the level 5 in addiction studies.
Yeah.
And if I hadn't have done that, I wouldn't have even done the certificate in equality studies. Wouldn't have even tried. It's the same product. The hard work. I remember on when I finished my degree, I'd only started working in Sale, like as a staff member. Like, I'd been doing peer work here and there. But it was so fucking funny. It was we were still only coming out of COVID, and we were on a clinical team meetings, it'd be on a Wednesday, and we were all in different rooms. So say on the Friday before, I had set up all the night before, and I had 2 assignments to finish off, got them in. Grant sitting on the desk and say, like, my phone on, and we're all taking turns at talking. And I heard someone, all I could hear was a bang, and I'm like, I'm lying on the ground in a pool of blood. My whole body just gave over. I was wheels on me bleeding chair. So everywhere, I must have fainted, but I cracked my head off the desk. The rest of the staff, all I could hear was everyone running, because I came back up to the screen. They said it was like watching your woman out of the ring. The hands come up, but blood flying down.
Jesus.
Like my body just gave up on me. Do you know the stress of just, I think I was just walking on adrenaline, getting everything in, and then the stress of it was just like, nah.
That's some drive, isn't it? Like, yeah. Kind of like, it's like, and you just keep going even though you're burnt.
For anyone, don't do that.
So somebody said to me, and it was good advice, or well, not advice, but information, is if you put half the amount of effort into the education as you did into scoring, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Because that wouldn't stop you from scoring.
Especially
you know?
In a drill.
Yeah. You know? We often travel to Dublin, do you know? But it's mad. Listen, Paul, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much for the invite.
Yeah. We'd love to visit your projects and meet some of the women that you work with.
Yeah, it'd be great. Yeah. Would you? Definitely have you down there. It'd be brilliant. Yeah. We'll organise that.
Yeah. Thanks for
we'll even give you a song.
Yeah.
Do you have that little choir and all?
I know Timmy sang with Christy Moore in the studio a few weeks ago, so he might sing it.
Brilliant.
Black is the colour.
Yeah.
Legs closed and all.
And don't listen to him now, he's trying to wind me up. I forgot the words halfway through the song.
He might have told you, he knows all the words.
I went into fight or flight during the song and I completely shut down and I forgot the words completely. So I bluffed my way.
Starstruck.
Well, we'll come up chat and maybe for. May I let you finish us off maybe with a word for the ladies that might be watching that's in prison at the moment?
Just keep your head down, you know, find what sort of you enjoy to do, you know, like for women to sort of find, because I found a lot of times, I think the education system in the prison needs to talk to the women and see what it is they'd like to do. Because a lot of times just doing hairdressing, and not every woman wants to be a hairdresser, not every woman wants to be a cook. Some women want to do things a little bit outside the box, but also for the prison system to value the lived experience that's in there. Do you know what I mean? And use that, you know, when they are creating anything. But for the women themselves to realise that the knowledge that they have, that lived experience, is huge, and to use that and not be afraid to use that voice, because nothing changes for you unless you start speaking up, you know. And don't be afraid that stigma and shame that you've experienced, that don't let it shut you down.
Yeah.
Because a lot of time, I think, as people who use drugs and people who've had a criminal past and all, we seem to fear speaking up because we fear straight away we're going to be shut down as, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Now we actually do. We have a lot of knowledge and a lot of wisdom to give.
That's great advice.
Well said. Thanks, Paula.
Thank you.
See everybody next week.
The Toonaries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.